Sefer Daniel, the book of Daniel. As we inch our way towards the conclusion of Tanakh, we have Daniel, then Ezra and Nehemiah, and then finally Divrei Hayamim. So Daniel is dedicated for a refuah shlema for Moshe Yehuda ben Chana Pesa and Masha bat Shena Kela. They shall have a refuah shlema. On your sheets, I gave you a reference to a passage from the 7th chapter in Daniel. If you take a look in your stone Tanakh, you want page 1795. The page numbers are there on the page. This is from Daniel's first vision. And I'll explain where the place of the visions in the book. But look at this. He describes seeing four immense beasts come up from the sea, each one different from the other. The first was like a lion. It had eagle's wings. I was watching as its wings were plucked, and it was removed from the earth, and it stood upon 2 feet like a man, and it was given a human heart. Then behold, another beast, a second one, similar to a bear. It was placed on one side. There were 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And this is what they said to it: arise, devour much flesh. After this, I was watching, and behold, another beast like a leopard with 4 birds' wings on its back. The beast had 4 heads, and it was given dominion. After this, I was watching in night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, exceedingly terrifying, awesome and strong. It had immense iron teeth, and it was devouring and crumbling and trampling with its feet what remained. It was different from all the beasts that had preceded it. It had 10 horns. And as I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a small one, came up among them, and 3 of the previous horns were uprooted before it. There were eyes like human eyes in this horn, and a mouth speaking haughty words. And then he says, I saw God. Because that's usually what happens in a dream at this point. I watched as thrones were set up, and the one of ancient days sat. His garment was white as snow, the hair of his head like clean wool. His throne was of fiery flames, its wheels blazing fire. A stream of fire was flowing forth from before him. 1,000 thousands were serving him, and so on. That's Daniel. That's a fun book. I'm not going to explore the meaning of his visions in any depth. But I want to show you that this is a book worth studying beyond 30 minutes. And I think that's the best way that I can do it. Now let's take a step back and talk about the book itself. So this is written in Galut Bavel, the time when the Jews are in Babylon, into the period when the Persians conquer Babylon. 11 years after his first trip through Israel, King Nebuchadnezzar of Bavel, of Babylon, came back and he exiled the leaders of the Jews. And Rashi and the Talmud in Sanhedrin says that that includes Daniel. He is in that leadership group that gets exiled. So if you follow the secular historical accounts, that puts these events in the 6th century before the Common Era. The Midrashic chronology has it in the 5th to 4th centuries before the Common Era. We're going to come back to that within this session. I'm not going to get away with these multiple chronologies much longer. For those who have learned Treyasar, those who were here with us several hours ago, so that puts him right before Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. The major themes addressed in the book: retention of our Jewish identity in Galut, in exile, and the idea that God looks after the Jews when they are in exile with miracles. The sanctification of God's name by Jews, even when we are in exile. The practical question, which is what I want to explore within this 30-minute unit, of how a Jew responds to a foreign government. How is a Jew supposed to respond to the government in this foreign land and the needs of that government? The punishment and partial rehabilitation of King Nebuchadnezzar is here as well, and lessons in the downfall of the arrogant. The divine hand controlling history. The divine empire on earth as the center of human history. All that and more in this incredible book. So, some background on the style of the book. It's a unified text, but it has 2 halves. It's very clear there are common themes between the stories that compose the first half and the visions that are in the second half. And the Dot Mikra edition tries to show how there are certain elements that show up continually through it. Nonetheless, there are 2 distinct halves, clearly identifiable in terms of their style. The first half of the book prose accounts of stories, some flowery language, particularly when it comes to addressing God, but basically it's a prose set of stories. The second half, dialogue between Daniel and Malachim, angelic beings discussing strange visions. The chronology of the two halves is not synchronized. It's not as though you could read it beginning to end and you're seeing things in chronological order. It's not true. The first half starts with Daniel and his friends in exile in Babylon and runs to the death of King Belshazzar and into and even beyond that, into the area of the Medes and the Persians after Babylon. However, the beginning of the second half is going to take us back into the reign of King Belshazzar all over again. So in other words, there's an overlap between the first half and the second half. The authorship of the book, so I brought you source number 3. I'm going to come back to number 2. Oh, I see what I did. No, never mind. I'm going to do them in order. That's a nice way to do it. I wanted to note that much of this book is actually written in Aramaic. Starting in chapter 2 with the account of Nebuchadnezzar's first dream that Daniel is going to interpret, and continuing until the end of chapter 7, which puts us in the visions half of the book. It's 6 chapters of one, 6 chapters of the other. So continuing it through the first vision, it's in Aramaic. Abarbanel has a theory of why it's in Aramaic, and that's what I brought you in source number 2. He says, in truth, simply it appears correct to say that Daniel wrote the introduction and end of his book in the sacred tongue, meaning Hebrew, because those were his own words to his nation, as well as the words of the Malach to him recorded afterward as they were stated. Our sacred tongue is the language God spoke to Adam and to the patriarchs and to Moshe, to his prophets, and this is the language the ministering Malachim use as mentioned by our sages. However, the words of the Chaldeans and Babylonians are not quite the same, but we're going to pretend they are for our purposes. In truth, they're not quite the same. Nonetheless, the words of the Kazdim and their kings, which were stated in Aramaic, and the words Daniel spoke to them in their tongue as well, he saw fit to record as they were stated. This is because errors and many forms of mistakes fall into translation from one tongue to another. So he said, let me be authentic, I'm going to stick with the original Aramaic. That's the idea that Abarbanel presents here. Later on in the book, Abarbanel floats a separate idea. And that is that the visions, except for the first one, the rest of the visions, are meant to take place after the fall of the Babylonian Empire, when no one is speaking Aramaic anymore, and therefore he phases out of Aramaic at that point. He says, well, what's the point? These are already post-Aramaic, if you will. So that's his later explanation. The book, now I come back to the authorship. Source number 3 tells you the great assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, are credited with writing this book. So whatever decisions Daniel made about using Aramaic, the great assembly ratifies it when they decide that this is the way it's going to appear in Tanakh. Clearly the central figure in this book is Daniel. Thank you. Here's an interesting thing. We always say his name wrong. You ever notice that? Take a look, right? If you take a look at the book itself, you find that where is the tsere? Where are the two dots in his name? The book begins on page 1774, right? And Daniel shows up in sentence 6. The tsere, the A, is under the yud. In other words, his name is not Daniel, it's Daniel. It's Daniel. Is actually the way that the name should be said. I've never heard any explanation for why this is so. It's an odd thing, because you would have assumed it's Daniel, right? Hashem has judged me, right? Just like any number of names, Yisrael, right?
Yisrael is the
same.
It's here
underneath the ayin. It's
underneath the ayin? Yeah, I noticed. Either Bar Yisrael or Yisrael, the son of Abram, has it underneath the ayin. One of those.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to take a look. Find it for me, please. Just overturning my universe here. But nonetheless, that's his name. His name is Daniel. Go figure. Daniel is from the tribe of Yehuda. You found it?
It's page 32.
Page 32. I've got to take a look at this. It's okay, because I'm giving the next year also, so I won't run over. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yishmael. That's really funny. I had not noticed that. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, no, you're right. There it is. It plays out with it being under the eye, and I don't believe I have noticed that before. Thank you. Now you have to know why, for both of them, it's like that.
That's Rabbi Yishmael has it with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's frankly where it belongs. Very interesting. Okay, thank you. You have to track that. The Daniel is from the tribe of Yehuda, and we find that out when, in the beginning of the book, on page 1775, we are told that the king wants to get representative of the Jews who are from the royal family. They want nobles. So that's where Daniel is coming from when he's selected for this group. We don't know how old he is, except that he has to be fairly young. At the start, Ibn Ezra pegs him at 15. That's the age that he gives. We know that he has to be able to learn the Babylonian script, the Babylonian language, and be impressive as he stands in the Babylonian court, and he has to have the restraint to stand in the court all day long. That's part of the job description when he's selected to be a member of the Babylonian court. We also don't know when he dies. He simply disappears at the start of the Persian period. So there are all sorts of theories, including that he may have returned to Israel with the Aliyah under the Persians, or he may have been demoted from his standing, or he found that he faced problems from the Persians, the members of the court, and he simply retired. He said, you know, I've had enough, I'd like to leave the court, or that he was executed, right? The demotion is found in the Gemara that places Daniel as Hatach in the Purim story is based on the idea that he suffered a demotion from his standing at one point due to the opposition of others. Interestingly, Yechezkel mentions a righteous man named Daniel in Yechezkel in the 14th chapter there, along with Noach and Iov, but that's likely Daniel, and that is not Daniel. No matter where you put the Tzeirah, it's actually a different figure from a different story. Daniel is clearly devoted to God. He is clearly devoted to Judaism. He davens, he prays frequently, even when he is under threat. Midrashim amplify, meaning under threat for davening, as we're going to see. The Midrashim amplify this. If you take a look at source number 4, look at this line. Rav says in the Gemara, talking about Mashiach, Imin Chayahu. If Mashiach is from the living, then he's like Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Imin Mesayahu, and if he's from the dead, well, then he'd have to be like Daniel. Daniel could have been Mashiach, is the way that he's presented here. I mentioned in one of the earlier sessions that Daniel is not viewed as a Navi. He's generally viewed as a Chacham, as a sage. And the Gemara and Megillah on that point is... are you right?
Yeah.
Okay. The Gemara and Megillah in source number 5 is one of the sources for this when it talks about the Chacham being better than the Navi. The sage is better than the prophet. And it proves it by saying, you know, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are on the scene with Daniel, and they cannot see that which Daniel is able to see. That's a little bit difficult in terms of the chronology, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi being on the scene with Daniel. Nonetheless, that's what this passage in the Gemara says. And again, as I said in that previous session, I think the fundamental reason to call him a Chacham rather than a Navi is because he doesn't have an audience. He's never told, go tell this to the nation. The kings of his day, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and Darius the Mede. Nebuchadnezzar being the brutal destroyer of the Beis HaMikdash, who is depicted here in this book as being incredibly murderously cruel. In the beginning of the book, in chapter 2, we find that he has a dream, and the dream is frightening to him. And so he summons his staff, and he says, here's the story. I had a dream. Your job is to tell me what I dreamed and what it meant. And if you don't, I will cut you up into small pieces. That's not an exaggeration. That's actually what he says. Right? What I dreamed and what it meant. And his counselors say to him, nobody can do that. And he says, excuses, excuses. You're all dead. That's what he says to them. Until Daniel comes up with the explanation and halts the slaughter. That's Nebuchadnezzar. He's a beastly human being who undergoes a humbling in the first four chapters. Then you have Belshazzar. Belshazzar is the son of Evil Merodach. He is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 5, there's a line that actually says that he is the son of Nebuchadnezzar. But he's not. It's just his son in the way that biblically often we conflate generations. Belshazzar is the last king of Babylon.
He... Vashti or is Vashti's daughter?
So right, there's this whole story about the connection between Belshazzar and Vashti. Vashti would be his daughter, not the... Right, she's married to Achashverosh, at least for a period of time. But Belshazzar is the one who holds a major feast on the last night of the Babylonian Empire, and then they're attacked by the Persians and the Medes, and you have the story which we're going to come back to with the writing on the wall. That's Belshazzar. And then after that, we're introduced to a king by the name of Darius the Mede. The Medes and the Persians are the conquerors of Babylon. And it's unclear who Darius the Mede is. Historians don't know he existed. Meaning we have historical records for all the other kings of this era. No one has any idea who Darius the Mede could have been. And the commentators differ on this, but fundamentally he reigns after the fall of Babel, the fall of Babylon. He is the one who was goaded by his advisors into throwing Daniel into the lion's den. So, the lions thought he existed. Outline of the book. Take a look at source number 7, please. Chapter 1, Daniel, as well as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are to be held in the Babylonian court as representatives of the captured Judeans. Chapters 2 through 6, Daniel's adventures in the royal courts. And these are the classic stories that people associate with Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. The dream scares him. It's a dream of the empires which are going to follow. This is something which actually has echoes in a Greek play. I'm blanking on the name now. The Myth of the Ages, something along those lines by Hesiod. And it's a play that actually precedes the events in Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar could have been familiar theoretically with this play, and in it, each age is associated with a particular material. And in his vision, he sees a big statue, and the head is of gold, and then you work your way down the body, and then there's silver, and then there's copper, and then there's iron and clay at the bottom, and then there's a stone that comes out and destroys everything. So this dream is the dream that scares Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel explains that it reflects a series of empires which will arise. Babel will not be around forever. In the next story, in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar makes a great big statue all of gold. And he insists that when the music plays, everybody has to bow to the statue. What is he doing? What is he doing? What's the point?
He's saying Rome in one age.
There will be only one age, exactly. Babylon forever. He's trying to get everybody to swear fealty to the Babylonian Empire, which is why there's a discussion in the Gemara, there's a discussion in Tosfos, as to whether it was an idol at all. It's not really an idol. It's simply a statue representing Babylon. Nonetheless, in that story, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow to the statue. Daniel is off the scene. Nebuchadnezzar did it when he was out of town. Not clear. Various explanations for Daniel is at this moment in time. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refuse to bow, and that's how they get what should have been a one-way ticket to a fiery furnace. That's right. They survived the trip. It turns out to be a round trip after all. The question is, if it wasn't really idolatry, why didn't they bow? Were they making a statement? A good discussion in its own right. And then Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And that dream is something we're going to come back to, but it's a dream of his own downfall. And Daniel interprets the dream and gives him advice to evade his downfall. And then finally, despite the advice of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar indeed falls victim to what was predicted in the dream, and he goes into exile for a brief period. We're going to come back to that. That's followed by the story of Belshazzar and the writing on the wall, which predicts that the empire is over, and then Daniel and Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede governs by coalition. He has people under him who run the government. However, there's a fear. The fear, which is played up by his advisors, is that if people come to if people are going to go to these echelons of authority instead of coming to Darius, then Darius's authority is undermined. And so they make a decree for 30 days, anyone who has anything that they want, you have to ask Darius. That's what the advisors get him to do. Why? Because they know that Daniel davens three times a day. This is our earliest record of a Jew davening three times a day. It says Daniel used to do this back in the time of the first temple, in the first Beis HaMikdash. He used to daven three times a day towards Yerushalayim. And he does it by a window, because he's Daniel. So he does it right by a window, and everybody can see that he is praying. And Darius does not want to throw him to the lions. But Daniel basically leaves him no choice. I did it, and I would do it again. So he throws him to the lions, and Daniel, of course, survives. And that's the end of the first half of the book. And then you get chapter 7 and 8 with visions of future empires and angels answering Daniel's questions. Chapters 9 and 10, Daniel recites a prayer on behalf of the Jews when he realizes that these dreams that he's having are predicting a very long exile. And then, following that, there are visions which Abarbanel believes predict the rise and fall of the Greek and Roman empires and Olam Haba and the resurrection of the dead. And that's where that piece, the piece that I excerpted in the beginning, comes from. A couple of issues that I have to at least mention. First, Christian use of this book. The church loves the book of Daniel. Right? I did this with Yeshaya 53. They love Daniel. So he has the vision of four successive empires, followed by a fifth that destroys everybody who came before. So the Christians read this as their takeover of Rome. They are the fifth empire that takes over Rome. Abarbanel says, you got to be kidding me. The vision says that the fifth one is going to last forever. But Christianity has been adopted and then rejected for Islam by some nations. What do you do about that? And he goes on and on with all his reasons why it can't be the Christian interpretation of the dream. In chapter 3, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah are in the furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar thinks he sees a fourth person inside the furnace. So the Christians say, yeah, that's our Savior. He's there. He's the fourth one in the furnace. To which Abarbanel says, come on, it's centuries before your chronology has him coming to earth. Why in the world do you think that he would be there in the furnace? They use it also to make calculations about when the Messiah will come and try to fit it with their religion. They love this book. And it's basically Don Isaac and Barbanel's job, every time they do it, to say, here are 34 reasons why this doesn't make any sense at all. That's his mission. Second key element of this book, Tchiyas HaMesim, the resurrection of the dead. If you take a look at the end of the book in chapter 12, the beginning of chapter 12, right, on page 1809, this is the most explicit reference to, the bottom of the page, this is the most explicit reference to a day of judgment and a resurrection from the dead. Many of those who sleep in the dusty earth will awaken, these for everlasting life and these for shame, for everlasting abhorrence, and so on. It's the prediction of Tchiyas HaMesim. And the use of this book to predict Mashiach. Jews have done this forever. Abarbanel did it. Even though the Gemara says that you're not supposed to predict the future, he said, yeah, that's when the future was far away. But now, it's here. Mashiach is here. He believed that the prediction in the book was that Mashiach was going to come in the year 1503. Oops, didn't come. Okay, I got it wrong. It was 1504. No, 1505. And then finally he gave up. But what he was basing himself on was fascinating. It's chapter 8, sentence 14. You'll see what he's basing himself on. Chapter 8, sentence 14. The angel says to him, until nightfall, morning, 2300. Now you look at that and say, oh, that's clearly 1502. No. What he's saying is this. Erev, evening, is a period of darkness and confusion and wasteland. And then Boker is Levaker, to examine. Bikur Cholim, to look after the needs of the sick. Levaker Bechalo, and so on. So Boker is examination by shining light. He says evening and morning is exile followed by redemption. And the years, he says, start with the split of Yehuda and Yisrael, which he dates to the year 2965. The splitting of the northern and the southern kingdom is where this starts, and then he says, count forward 2,300 years, and that gets you to the year 1503. Because in the year 1503, we will reunite under the rule of Mashiach ben David, the house of David. The two kingdoms are again united, and that's when we will be redeemed. That was his idea, which he published. And then he had to, you know, try to update every year until he gave up. He said, you know, maybe they were right. I shouldn't calculate. Okay. Shabtai Tzvi would not be for another 160 years after that. 1660s. Okay. So, in my introductory video on Daniel, when we were promoting Tanakh in a Day, I talked about how Daniel stood apart from the Babylonians. How in chapter 1, he rejects the king's food. He says, I am not your pet, eating from the king's table. Without a doubt, Daniel does not view Babylon as home. He davens towards Yerushalayim 3 times a day. He prays for redemption for the Jews. But he finds a way to live as a Jew within his environment. And that's what I mean when I say a Jewish dreamer in Babylon. Not the literal dreams of the second half of the book, but the metaphorical dream of the first half, in which he functions as part of Nebuchadnezzar's court, and he contributes despite his discomfort. And here we get to the story that begins at the end of chapter 3 and runs into chapter 4. This is the story of Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. If you look at the end of chapter 3, you want page 1785. Nebuchadnezzar writes a letter to go throughout the empire to tell people about what happened to him. And here is his story. He had a terrible dream. And in the interest of time, I'm going to have to sandwich it, but you can see it here in front of you. He has a dream in which he sees an immense tree, which provides benefit to everybody. It provides shade, it provides fruit, it provides a place for the birds to rest. Everything relies on this tree. The tree is clearly King Nebuchadnezzar. That's what he dreams of. And then he dreams that there is a decree that the tree should be cut down. Chop down the tree, cut off its branches, cast down its foliage, scatter its fruit, let the animals move away from under it, the birds from its branches, only leave the major roots in the ground, secured with a band of iron and copper, will be washed by the dew of the heavens for 7 periods of time. Now, in this case, he tells everybody what he dreamed. And he just demands, explain the dream for me. And no one wants to explain the dream for him. Not because they don't know, but because he's Nebuchadnezzar. And he will kill you mercilessly for telling him that his empire is over. So no one wants to be the one to say this to him. Finally, Daniel does. Daniel explains the dream to him. He says, you're going to be made to wander. Interestingly, Abarbanel, on the flip side of the sheet in source number 12, suggests that what happens to him is depression. Ibn Ezra did this before Abarbanel, but Abarbanel writes it at length, as Abarbanel does. But Daniel says to him, this is your fate. You are going to be dragged down from your position of power, but here's how you can avoid it. You can avoid it by giving tzedakah. That's what Daniel says to him. And that's what he does. He gives tzedakah. And then for a year, he is spared this fate until ultimately he expresses his arrogance. He says, I am great. He's out on his roof walking around. And he looks out over his kingdom and he says, I built this. And at that point, suddenly, the arrogance trips it. And he suffers the fate that was predicted for him in the dream. Now, the big question is this. Why in the world do you help him, Daniel? Why do you want to help this cruel, vicious, horrible human being who is responsible for the destruction of the temple, who is responsible for the deaths of thousands upon thousands of Jews, who is responsible for the exile of the Jewish people, not to mention you see how he behaves. You see how he conducts himself. Why do you want to help this man? If God is saying he's going to be torn down, let it happen. Why are you trying to forestall it? So you could answer that it's pragmatic. He's increasing his standing in the court of the Babylonians by explaining that this is what's going to happen. Could be. Rashi says, based on a Medrash Tanchuma, that he's trying to help the Jews. Because the needy people in the empire who are going to receive the tzedakah are the Jews who have been exiled from Israel. They're the needy ones. So therefore, they'll get some help this way. But another way to look at it is that he's attempting to be helpful because Daniel thinks that that's what the Jew in Galut, the Jew in exile, is supposed to do. Abarbanel writes, it makes sense. For a sin of arrogance, you atone by humbling yourself and helping the needy. Right? What's an example of this in Chumash? Who did this long before Daniel? Yosef, right? Yosef explains Paro's dream, and he doesn't leave it there. He doesn't stop and say, okay, 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. He gives him a whole explanation of what he ought to do in order to take care of things. You think of Mordechai with Achashverosh. Mordechai finds out about a plot against Achashverosh. He says, I'm going to find out. I'm going to tell the king and save the king. Now, interestingly, Daniel is criticized. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that Daniel is punished for advising Nebuchadnezzar. Presumably because you forestalled divine punishment for his sins. Although Rabbi Yaakov Meidan has a very interesting idea that I brought you in source number 14. He says, Daniel is wrong because telling him to give tzedakah is like the band-aid on the fracture. Right? Meaning, you can't just give tzedakah as a means of righting all your wrongs, Nebuchadnezzar. This doesn't make you a good person now. He hasn't really done tshuva, he hasn't really repented. But I think what we get here, and I said it briefly because, you know, time's running and we have to start Ezra Nehemiah shortly, but I think this gives us a lot to think about in our own day and our own position. Because here we are, right? You have that whole display out in the school lobby of Jews and the positions they've held in Canada over the decades, and those who have been in a position where they could influence and they could do something. And the question is, do you follow the Daniel model? Do you say, I am going to help the government? Right, which isn't like Nebuchadnezzar, I'm glad to say. You say, I'm gonna help the government? Or do you say, you know what, this is not for us, this is not who we are. We should be more like the Gemara is here and say, you're not supposed to assist the throne. It's a very interesting question, which I think Daniel puts before us. So to go to my last question for Daniel, and then we'll start Ezra and Nehemiah. How does this affect my relationship with God? Well, first of all, it's a statement that being in exile does not mean that God has abandoned us. Daniel and his friends experience miracles even when they are in galut, even when they are in exile. I think it shows we have a meaningful role to play in Kiddush Hashem, in sanctifying God's name. I think it's a lesson in looking for the divine hand in history, particularly when you get to the second half of the book. And we have to ask ourselves, what does God want of us when we are here in exile? Does God intend for us to take an active part in the nation? Or does God intend for us to watch things happen around us? All of these, I think, are things we should think about as we learn Sefer Daniel. There's a sheet in the back for Ezra and Nehemiah.